Thank you very much. So good afternoon, everyone. So first of all, I would like to thank you for the possibility to present some results here. So the topic is indeed, I think, connecting to some other talks we had. So I will be focused in the main part of my talk on the kind of on the potential of IPEPS, tensor network wave function, to describe quantum critical system, which in two space dimensions with an additional time dimension. So we're kind of interested in three space-time dimensions critical systems. So that's the main part of my talk. And if time remains, I will also revisit some with some, I hope, new ideas how you can do similar things in one dimensions where the field is already quite mature, but there's still some little bit of room for improvement. So the introduction, I think I can keep that short since we're having a workshop on quantum matter anyway. But most of us are interested in understanding phase diagrams and in complicated, complex quantum systems. Quantum phase transitions happen and occur, so we would like to characterize them. And so in principle, we would still welcome new tools to characterize and diagnose quantum field theories at phase transitions. Just as another quick motivation, there are two phase diagrams of models we have been looking at in the past, so we don't want to detail their precise Hamiltonians and the phase diagrams, but what should kind of strike you is that there are phase diagrams within a small parameter range. There are many different phases popping up, and both are actually systems where still some open questions on the nature of the phase transitions are open. So for here, for example, that's a quantum spin model on a triangle lattice. There is an extended chiral spin liquid region here. Here there's some magnetic order. Here there's some putative Dirac spin liquid or C2 spin liquid down here. And a lot of the phase transitions between different phases here are still open for discussion. It's not clear what could happen. Perhaps some version of QED3 with various numbers of flavors or something, or some topological terms. Here, on the other hand, there is a spinless fermion model on the honeycomb lattice with competing repulsions on nearest neighbor and next nearest neighbor interactions. And here also just the sheer number of phases with different colors. So there are different bulk phases, but the phase transition between many of them are not really understood. And in some cases here, for example, between the semi-metal and the charge density wave, it's believed to be a chiralizing transition. But even there, I think there are still, at least in some with some methods, still tensions between critical exponents, between, say, analytic and numerical techniques. So I think there's still room for techniques to look at quantum phase transitions. And so in the first part of my talk, I'm now going to tell you about some excursions we did in looking at the IPEPS tensor network technique using state-of-the-art kind of computational methods to ask some questions to what extent these wave functions are able to reproduce or to model quantum critical behavior. So our work has been published last year in PhysRefX in that paper, and actually we were in Philippe Corbeau and his group had a companion paper which was published back to back and had a significant overlap in the results. Okay, and this work here was the hard work was mostly done by Michael Rader, who's a last year PhD student in my group in Innsbruck. So thanks to the nice introduction this morning by Mike on PEPS, I think I can keep this part relatively short. So what our approach is that we're looking at completely translation invariant PEPS tensor network wave functions. So the basic structure you can see here. So these green balls represent one IPEPS tensor. And so, as you have seen this morning, contracting a network given fixing the values, for example, of some spins on the lattice on the physical leg here. If you contract the rest of the network, it gives you a number, and that's the amplitude of your many-body wave function for all the different spin configurations you can choose. So this goes back to work by Frank Restrati and Ignacio Sirac, where they proposed these ansatz kind of in the modern quantum information language, and then work by Guifri and others here came up with the idea to actually directly operate in the thermodynamic limit, which basically on a technical level amounts to using a unit cell in our case, it's actually only a unit cell of a single tensor, which you then replicate in an infinite amount to cover the entire two-dimensional spatial plane. But that obviously reduces the number of variational parameters quite a bit. But it actually turns out to be a unique and quite an interesting kind of setup also to do quantum many-body systems to directly work in the thermodynamic limit. And so these are indeed, there are two aspects to IPEPS which are, I think, worth mentioning. On the one side, there is this particular tensor network structure, which you call PEPS, which is, of course, is a limitation compared to the general structure an arbitrary wave function could have in the Hilbert space. So we write a tensor network ansatz. And then the other thing is also something which perhaps is actually not recognized by as such sufficiently, I would say, is that working directly with these infinite matrix product states or IPEPS method actually has a lot of advantages, but also has a few challenges also with relation to statistical mechanics and quantum field theory, which are, I think are still worth exploring a bit more. And so one of the driving questions for our study was actually to understand better to what extent now the specific IPEPS framework is suited to study quantum critical systems. So with quantum critical systems, we mean like many of the quantum critical points I mentioned in the introduction are believed to be described by Lorentz invariant long distance infrared conformal field theories. But these conformal field theories, they really live in three space-time dimensions. So many of these aspects are until recently were poorly understood. Now with the conformal bootstrap, we know much more about them, but they're still not exactly solved. So we don't have this whole catalog of CFTs, which many of us know quite well in 1+1, so in two space-time dimensions. So in 3D, these are much more open. And I think up to our work, it was not really clear how IPEPS wave functions can actually, how much of that physics they can actually can be reproduced. On the other hand, many of you, and I think Mike also mentioned this morning, it's actually known that if you take, for example, the partition function of a classical Ising model, which is a classical 2D StatMech problem, you can actually encode the partition function of a 2D classical Ising model in such a PEPS here with a translation invariant with a bond dimension d equals 2. And since that's the exact partition function which can represent as this infinite tensor network, if you contract it and you evaluate observables like spin-spin correlations, you will, if you tune the parameters of your partition function to the critical temperature, you will find critical correlations. And so the question is now, if we optimize now using numerical optimization techniques, our tensor network ansatz for a quantum critical system like the transverse field Ising model, as many of us look at its quantum critical point, which lives in three space-time dimensions, the question is, what is the structure of the PEPS? Is it also providing directly power law correlation function, or is something else happening? And if something else is happening, what we do with the results, to what extent do we still learn something about the critical properties? So that's the motivation. And also building on the discussion this morning. So what we use basically on the IPEP side, we implemented state-of-the-art techniques which were developed by others. So there are two things which are still important to mention. On the one hand, we used state-of-the-art optimization methods. We actually started out in the beginning using optimization techniques, using kind of a brute force numerical gradient calculations, which were quite expensive, but gave rise to quite good energy. Because this full update imaginary time evolution, which was used a lot before, they actually turn out not to give extremely good energies for a fixed bond dimension, and so there's still room for improvement. And then while we were working on it, Philip Corbo and also Frank Verstrati's group had somewhat different approaches to actually calculate gradients directly in the tensor network formulation, and then using this method one could change, optimize the tensors and get significantly lower energies. And it turned out that actually having really almost the best energies for a tensor of a given bond dimension is quite important. So that's one ingredient. And the other one, as discussed this morning, contractions is among the heavy parts of such an IPEPS implementation. And in order to be sure that what we get out is really not dependent on the contraction, we actually use both two different versions to to compute the environment, to do the contractions of the infinite planar network. So one is this boundary MPS. That's the technique which was discussed this morning. There is also a different technique called corner transfer matrix, which has similarities, but it's still a bit different. So here in this boundary MPS, there is like one looks basically for an eigenvector of the infinite line transfer operator and writes that as an infinite MPS. So that's one scheme, which is somehow like line oriented. And another setup is this corner transfer matrix, where you're somehow interested in the environment of a central site, which is denoted by this X here. And then the environment is written as four corners. So these are these four boxes, which have a square form. And then there are also some remnants here, like a transfer operator on a line. And so this corner transfer matrix, in some cases, we can converge that to larger kind of intrinsic bond dimension in the environment. And so we were using both in order to check that our results do not depend on the contraction techniques. And now, since the correlation length actually plays an important role, I just briefly want to mention how we deal with that. So in this, if you're interested to calculate the correlation function, you can actually represent this in terms of an environment. So there's an environment U here, which is a channel which has like one of the operators hidden in it. Then there's a certain number of the transfer operator acting, like r minus 1 times, where r is like the distance of the linear displacement of the two operators in the expression. And then v is somehow the environment where the second operator in the correlation function is hidden. And so you see that even if you don't specify what the operators hidden in U and V are, all the correlations somehow are hidden in this transfer operator object. And therefore, if you can somehow look at the spectrum, you can also figure out what is the mode which decays most slowest. And for this, you somehow look at the eigenvalue problem of the transfer operator, and then you get the spectrum of eigenvalues lambda. And if you normalize this correctly, then lambda naught is kind of the leading eigenvalue. It has eigenvalue 1. But then the other ones are smaller, and out of this you can calculate the correlation length like it is done in transfer matrix methods in 2D StatMech and so on. So that was one ingredient. And then while we were working with it, there was also a paper by Marek Rams et al., where they actually found some clever way to extrapolate the results for this correlation length, because it turns out that there's still some subtle dependence of the correlation length which we get using this approach from the finite bond dimension which is hidden in the environment. And there's some technical improvement which they suggested to actually somehow extrapolate the results for finite bond dimension in the environment to infinite bond dimension using this form, which works quite nicely. And in some cases, we had to work with this approach. Okay, so much for the kind of the technical kind of the explanation of what kind of technical tools and questions we look at. And now we're looking also at the Drosophila of kind of quantum many body investigations, the transverse fieldizing model, but here we're looking at the version in two space dimensions and one time dimensions. So that's our model, and we actually also include not only the transverse field here, which we call H, coupling to the sigma x, but we also have a longitudinal field Hc in our Hamiltonian, and this is like a cartoon representation of the phase diagram. You have the transverse field H, which like in a 3D StatMech setting plays the role of the temperature. So that's like the temperature axis, if you wish. And that one is the magnetic field axis, which couples to the order parameter. And as you know, in the absence of a magnetic field, this Ising model has a phase transition or a quantum phase transition at the critical transverse field. And below it, it's magnetically ordered, has a spontaneous C2 magnetic order symmetry breaking. However, for any finite magnetic field in the order parameter direction, the system is completely paramagnetic. And so now we're going to look at how the IPEPS technique using a finite bond dimension is actually going to deal with this phase diagram. And as you actually can see here, the black dot is basically the transverse field in the thermodynamic limit, which we mostly take from a reference quantum Monte Carlo calculation, because this point is relatively well known. And actually, what we will find in a minute is that if you work with finite bond dimensions, like bond dimension 2 or 3, now for the PEPs, which is really, so d equals 2 is really the bare minimum you can do beyond mean field, because d equals 1 is a product state, is like a site mean field. So d equals 2 is the next best you can do, which is an actually genuine PEPs. And then you actually also did d equals 3. And actually, it turns out that d equals 3 is already so accurate that it becomes very hard to get better results for d equals 4. So for the Ising model, even with very modest bond dimensions, we can already get quite accurate results, as we're going to see in the following. So what is shown here now is something where the correlation length is not yet entering. What we're doing is now is in a small window here for the transverse field in the absence of a longitudinal field. What we do is for the two different bond dimensions, D2 and D=3 are the different colors. We optimize many different H values, transverse fields, and we squeeze the try to squeeze the best energy out of it, and then we measure, in that case, the magnetization in the z direction. So first of all, if you would do that kind of in a finite size setting, and you have arbitrary large bond dimension on a finite size system, you know that typically the symmetries are not spontaneously broken, so you would always expect mz to be zero by, that's like a symmetry of the model, and in finite volume, you would not expect this to be broken spontaneously. But similar, like in the IMPS case, which is well explored, it also turns out, and in the IPEPS case, that that in the region where the system in the thermodynamic limit breaks the symmetry spontaneously, there is also finite magnetization in the best IPEPS wave functions. And so now, if you look, what happens is that indeed for a transverse field large enough, there are solutions coming out where the magnetization in the z direction is zero. And then there's a sharp onset, which actually looks mean field-like for d equals 2. And then it starts to rise. And here, that's 3. So that 3.04, 3 or something is the critical point. So that's actually just a percent away from the critical point. Then the magnetization is already at 35% of the value of its maximum value. So you can actually see that this transition here is about at 3.09. So also for d equals 2, this is very close already to the critical point. And d equals 3 is like one part in a thousand or so away from the numerically known critical point. So that's one observable, mz, as a function of the transverse field. And down here, it's a different observable. That's the transverse magnetization, also in the same H thing. So you can see there is actually at the same location where the longitudinal magnetic field is vanishing, there is a change of slope in the singularity here in the transverse magnetization as well. And that actually keeps being the case. But these two locations where the magnetization here vanishes in the z direction is the same thing where there's a change of slope in the transverse magnetization. So that's one cut in this two-dimensional phase diagram. That's changing the transverse field at zero longitudinal field. And then we can make an orthogonal cut where we're sitting at the correct transverse field, but we're changing the longitudinal field. And here you can see that the response is actually quite dramatic. So basically, here it shoots up quite quickly as we change the longitudinal magnetic field. That's true both for d equals 2 and d equals 3. And that's also the corresponding value for the transverse magnetic field. And first of all, what is interesting about this, if you compare to previous results in the literature, is that previous results, if you would zoom so closely to the critical properties, would actually depend quite a lot on the precise parameters of the full update. And so these are now results which we hope will remain constant in time, at least for these bond dimensions. That's due to this more sophisticated optimization algorithm, which try to really to find the global minimum of this tensor ansatz for these bond dimensions. And so what you can do now is then try to extract the critical exponents by really following the textbook definitions. So we measure the Z magnetization in the ordered phase and track it as a function of the deviation from the magnetic field. And if you take a log-log and the slope, then you can actually extract something like the critical exponent beta. And so what is shown here, so I'm not going to discuss all these plots in all detail, but in principle, these are always one the MC or the MX kind of a critical, the observable plotted as a deviation from the critical point. And so here we change the transverse field, and in the right panel we change the longitudinal field. And what you can see is that plot looking at this in the inset, if h minus hc is sufficiently large, so we're far away from the critical point, and going to the left, we go closer to the critical point. And if we look at the numerical derivative of these curves, we actually see how these curves start to rise, and this slope approaches the dashed value, and the dashed value is like the expected critical exponent from, say, the conformal bootstrap, so which we can consider as reference results for the moment. And what is nice to see here is that this result really, as you go closer and closer to the critical point, they get closer and closer, and up to a few percent, we get the correct critical exponent. Before then, going even closer to the critical point, we have a problem, because then the finite bond dimension apparently leads to an incorrect representation. But going from d equals 2 to d equals 3, we somehow cover the region closer to the critical point more accurately before the finite bond dimension seems to set the limitation on the results we get. And in this case, here we're probing a different kind of exponent, since we're perturbing with the longitudinal magnetic field. And here actually the critical exponents is actually the maximum we get before the finite D effects kick in are actually really quite close to the expected critical exponents. And in that variable, it's also true. So that's already quite nice, because we start, this does not depend on some kind of a biased choice of a fitting range. I just take numerical derivatives of the data as I approach the critical point. And so in that sense, this is a relatively unbiased way to get an estimate for these critical exponents. Okay, but up to now, there was no correlation length involved in this. So let's look at how the correlation length behaves now in the vicinity of this phase transition. So here is again the axis with the transverse field changing between 3 and 3.1. And in the lower part here, these are the results for bond dimension d equal 2. For d equals 2, remember that's the first kind of non-trivial case beyond the product state. And the correlation length which we measure here across this region, and having the maximum, the kink at the value where the longitudinal magnetization vanishes, the maximum correlation length is here just a little bit beyond 1.6 lattice spacings. So with d equals 2, even though we get overall quite good results, the correlation length, the maximum one we find is only 1.6 lattice spacing, and that's really quite a short correlation length to model a quantum critical phenomenon. However, the d equals 3 case is much harder numerically to really get convergent, because the energy difference, as we will see, is actually quite small. So here we find also the peak, the maximum correlation length at this kind of pseudo-transition where the PEPS loses its magnetic order. And here we find the maximum correlation length in the d equals 3 case of up to 12 lattice spacing. So that's already, it's of course not infinite, but it's a sizable correlation length.
How do we get correlation length?
No, we look at the transfer operator.
Yeah, but do you put first of all the pass on the cylinder?
No, no.
So you
no.
Check the first.
Here. So we, once you know
yeah,
the boundary MPS.
You need, like, to first get like boundary MPS.
Yes.
Yeah. And then,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and also to get the results, we extrapolate also in the bond dimension of the environment. Otherwise, there would be still be visible effects here that if you, even though we go to quite high bond dimension in the environment of a few hundred or sometimes even a thousand, then there's still effects that the environment induces a drift on the correlation length. But these are the extrapolated values. But even the largest one we get are like perhaps 10 or 11 or something. So it's not a huge... It's not a huge effect, but it's visible on this scale. Okay, and we can also look at at the correlation length in the direction of the longitudinal magnetic field. So here we can also see if the longitudinal magnetic field is very strong, of course, the correlation length goes close to zero. D equals 2 just rises a little bit to this value of about 1.5 or so, 1.6. But D equals 3 actually rises quite a lot, and it goes up to about this 10 or 12. And now you can actually also try to compare this with expectations for the critical exponent nu, which is the correlation length divergence exponent. So since the correlation length is a bit more imprecise value, so it's harder to get that very accurate, we're not taking a derivative, but at least by plotting the expected nu exponent in if you perturb the system with the magnetic longitudinal magnetic field, we see that these results which you obtain are kind of compatible with the expected power law divergence of the correlation length as we approach the critical point coming from the finite longitudinal magnetic field. So far, that's quite good. But there's still a bit the puzzle, why are we only doing D equals 2 and 3 and perhaps not 4? Because other groups on other models are like using bond dimensions of the order of 10 or sometimes even 20. So why is that? So technically, we're able to actually look at larger Ds. We will see that for other models a bit later. But why is it actually that there's only 2 and 3? And something where you can start to guess something is something which we did, which I think has not been done this way in this context, is to actually phrase now the quality, the variational quality of our IPEPS network in some kind of quantum field theoretical framework, to put it a bit broadly. Namely, we try to understand whether we can phrase the variational energy as a kind of a Casimir effect, where somehow the length scale of the correlation length somehow tells us how the functional form of how the variational energy actually scales. So the idea is basically, I'm going to have a slide with a bit more formulas as the next one, but the idea is basically in these three-dimensional space-time quantum field theories, if you have a system which is in a finite volume, there is a Casimir effect which will scale with the third power of that length scale. And the prefactor depends on the actual geometrical form, but there's like a power 3, 1 over power 3 of the correlation length scaling. And so what we do first is looks a bit brave. But actually, we're looking here. We take our best energy at the quantum critical point for d equals 2 and d equals 3, and we plot them on an axis where we plot 1 over xi to the third, where xi is our correlation length, and then we extrapolate it. But you can already see that since the correlation length of the d equals 3 result is like 10 or 12, 1 over 12 is already like 1,000. So on that axis, that's actually very close to the 1 over xi to the 3 being 0 result. So that extrapolated energy, which would extrapolate, is basically very close to the results we already have for d equals 3. Now you could say, with 2 points, we can fit basically anything we want. So is there some further proof or illustration that this behavior is actually correct? And so what we do now is that we arrange all our data sets, which we have shown so far in the vicinity of the critical point. We plot them all as a function of their respective 1 over xi to the 3 correlation length. And on this axis, we basically plot their variational quality, which means we take this extrapolated value here. That's our reference energy, which we call EIPEPS at infinite bond dimension, kind of. And we take the variational energy of these wave functions, which most of them have been optimized at locations for slightly off critical. But we can still ask what is their energy if we evaluate their energy at the critical point. So then they have a variational offset. And this plot is kind of suggesting that this 1 over xi to the 3, at least apart from some prefactor which might change, but the overall behavior that the variational quality scales with the third power, inverse third power of the correlation length, seems to be a plausible assumption. At least the data is not ruling that hypothesis out. Okay, and so can we somehow try to make that a bit more plausible or put that into a perspective? And so the idea is actually to look at the finite volume kind of Casimir effect. Many of you who do finite volume calculations know that, for example, the energy density in finite volume, where L is the linear extent of, say, a cubic box or something, is is given as the E in the infinite volume limit minus some kind of a universal number which depends on the quantum field theory, on the torus aspect ratio tau, and then there's a velocity, which okay in the field theory would be one, in the microscopic model can be non-universal, and then it has a 1 over L to the 3 scaling. And for example, in another work, other people have looked at this, what is this value of this alpha, for example, from the 3D Ising CFT in a square torus in infinite zero temperature limit. And then, for example, that number is like 0.35, which basically means like if you take L to the 3, L equals 10 or something, there is still this 0.35 divided by 1,000 here as a prefactor. And these are established results kind of in the finite volume if you put the quantum field theory in finite volume. And what we now do in our case is that we conjecture kind of a finite correlation length scaling of the variational energy using a similar ansatz, where we now say our E of xi is E at infinite correlation length minus a different, possibly different, value for alpha, because it's a different kind of geometry, so it might have a different prefactor, times velocity divided by xi to the 3. And now if we actually take our results, our IPEPS results, we know what xi is, we know our E of xi results because we have optimized for them, then we can now fit using a velocity, which is also known from previous studies, we actually now figure out that our alpha IPEPS, you see, is a minus 0.00061. And what should strike you now is that if we take our ansatz seriously, then it turns out that the IPEPS, if you want space-time geometrical aspect, somehow has an alpha, like a Casimir coefficient, which if you take here the correlation length as the proxy for our length scales instead of the linear extent in the finite volume case, then our alpha here is like 3 orders of magnitude smaller. And that, so with the correlation length of 10 and this factor here of 1,000, we actually believe that our energies is, which we get here for the infinite correlation length case is probably accurate to about 6 or 7 digits already at t equals 3. And so on the other hand, if you now ask, okay, if I start to optimize t equals 4, then our correlation length is likely even larger, perhaps like 20 or 30 or 50, we don't know. But if you put that to the third power, you get such a small energy difference to the infinite correlation length case that you actually need a very high resolution in variational optimization to really go to that regime. And so we think that is an explanation perhaps why it's actually so difficult to optimize t equals 4 with better energies than t equals 3, because the energy gain is so small that you have to have very accurate resolution of this energy gain. Yes?
Sorry, does this number alpha IPEPS have some scheme independent meaning?
At this stage, I think I'm not entirely sure. I think in the one-dimensional IMPS case, I have some understanding that I think this could be related to something like a conformal perturbation theory result, like what is a universal amplitude of something like this stress energy tensor expectation value, if you express that in terms of an induced correlation length. But I think in this context, it's not. I mean, I'm not sure anyone can calculate that using perturbed conformal field theories in 3 dimensions, but it might actually have a, at least there might be a CFT, a perturbed CFT number which comes close to that.
But the sign seems to be opposite.
Yeah, but I think this is once you accept that the finite volume case typically has energies which come from below. Since here we're working strictly variational, we have to come from above. So the sign difference, I think that's easy to understand. But the quantitative difference is surprising. Okay, so that was the discussion for the Ising case. Then we moved on within IPEPS to the continuous symmetry breaking case, which is also a relativistic invariant case. So here the kind of the field theoretical setting before we show you some results for microscopic model is kind of a Goldstone phase. So we have like you could for example think about the non-linear sigma model with collinear magnetic. Collinear magnetic order or symmetry breaking. And as many of you know, this ON nonlinear sigma model has some hydrodynamic parameters like velocity, spin stiffness, and the ordered moment which enter. And here, because this is a very, I mean, this phenomenon arises in many different situations. Field theoretical people like Hasenfratz and Niedermeyer and others have actually calculated leading order forms of the energy density in finite volume, also to higher orders, and also what is the renormalization of the magnetic order parameter as a function of the finite volume. And these are rather famous formulas, where n now is the n in On here, so for O2 and O3, which we're going to look at, this would be 2 and 3. And also this alpha nonlinear sigma model for like square Torr ions, so they are known. And there's also a corresponding Casimir, if you want, amplitude also for the squared magnetic moment. But the interesting point is that in case once you know them for a given ON model, then you can actually also predict what would be the finite size correction for a different ON. So from 2 to 3, for example, you can change N because the N dependence is contained in here. And if you know, then, for example, these non-universal hydrodynamic parameters, you can actually predict what the corrections are in a different case. And the same can actually, you can also do the yeah. And so what we do now is to translate the finite volume case into finite correlation length. So we conjecture that we have a different alpha, which is now like in the IPEPS realm, but it scales as 1 over psi to the 3 here. And the renormalization of the magnetic order parameter has its own constant, but it scales as 1 over psi because it was 1 over L before. And so now what we have done first is to take the square lattice antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model, which is for spin 1/2. And this has a magnetic order, collinear magnetic order. It breaks O3 spontaneously. And so what we have done now is here we had access to a larger range of D values. So we optimized using our scheme D equals 2, 3, 4, and 5. And so we have we don't change any other Hamiltonian parameter. We just have this one model. So there are just these kind of 5 data points. And what we do here now is we take the best variational energies which we have. So we put them here on that axis. And since we have this conjecture that our results should organize as 1 over psi to the 3, we plot them on the 1 over psi to the 3 axis. And as you can see, these the three largest data points here, they really seem to be quite nicely on a linear line. And then also there is here this small star. That's a high precision quantum Monte Carlo result from Anders Sandvik, which is here. And you can see that these three data points actually extrapolate quite nicely with a small error compared to the reference QMC result. And that actually, I think, solves an important problem, because in the PEPT literature so far, people mostly, I mean, they knew that it was not working very precisely, but were mostly looking at the results as a function of bond dimension and using some heuristic fit. But here it seems this 1 over psi to the 3 kind of extrapolation is on much more kind of a theoretical footing, or at least on a scenario of how the correlation length is actually regulating the variational energy. And that seems to work quite nicely. On the other hand, and I think that's also kind of working, I think that's kind of interesting, is that we can also measure the spontaneous magnetic moment. So as in the Ising case at criticality, there's a spontaneous magnetic moment in the best IPEP solution. So we measure it and we square it. And then we plot this m squared as a function now as 1 over psi, because that's the adapted version of the finite volume scaling which we refer. And then you can also see these results really lie quite nicely on a linear slope. And if you extrapolate that, what we hit here is again the high precision reference results from the QMC. And so that's actually, I think, quite nice. And that somehow framing the results of these IPEPs optimizations in terms of the correlation length seems to be a good way to actually extrapolate to infinite bond dimension via a controlled understanding of what the correlation length is actually doing. And now we can actually also test this hypothesis that this underlying nonlinear sigma model description is also perhaps is making sense. So we can now fit these alphas and the mu's, which we advocated as kind of nonlinear sigma model properties. So we have these numbers. And what we do next is taking the XY model on the square lattice, which has n from 3 to 2. So we change n. The microscopic parameters like velocity and stiffness will also change. But otherwise, it's also an incarnation of the nonlinear sigma model. And so what we do is indeed we take this model. We optimize for the same ranges of these. And here, the QMC results are actually not that accurate, because they're like close to 20 years old. But anyway, so the dashed line here behind the legend, that's the fit to the largest data points from the bare XY data. And this violet line here, that's the nonlinear sigma model prediction, which means we take these alphas and mus from the other, from the Heisenberg cake. We change the microscopic parameters, but they have the N dependence predicted by the nonlinear sigma model prediction. And as you can see, I think this slope here, which is very close to the one which we have in the actual data, and also for the one for the how the magnetic moment kind of extrapolates, I think is for such a hand-waving theory, if you want, is actually quite remarkable how well that works. So it seems, I think one of the nice things is that I think it's a good idea that somehow these, to understand that these IPEPS results are not just somehow have some random noise due to the finite bond dimension, but actually that this is embedded into hopefully a well-defined kind of phenomenological theory where the finite bond dimension induces a finite correlation length. And even though we don't understand this connection very well, but once you have the finite correlation length, then somehow the results organize in a clean kind of quantum field theoretical setting. Okay? And then one can also look at kind of now in a summary plot where how the maximum correlation length which we find for these different physical scenarios depend on the bond dimension D. And then we see some quantitative difference. So for the transverse field Ising model, which is like a single isolated quantum critical point, we see that the maximum correlation length we get is very small for D equals 2, but for D equals 3 is already like of the order of 10 or 12. Whereas in the Heisenberg, in the XY case, we actually see that growth of the maximum correlation length is actually substantially smaller. If you're brave, you can even plot that on a log-log plot, but okay, I mean, it's really hard to be sure that these numbers make sense, but still you can plot it. And then what we think, some of the things is that since the Ising model is like the theory with the least degrees of freedom, I think from many points of view, it could also be like in one dimension that this is really a case where the connection between bond dimension and correlation length like leads to the fastest growth among many theories you can look at. And however, as people here also know from the entanglement scaling calculation, once you have these Goldstone breaking phases, for example, in terms of entanglement, they also have a contribution from the Goldstone modes, which leads to a logarithmic violation of the area law. And so it could actually also be that here, in this case, the Goldstone character of the symmetry breaking leads to a more slow growth of the correlation length with the number of bond dimension with the bond dimension, and you can also see that the XY in the Heisenberg case they actually differ kind of a factor 2 in their correlation length, and it could also be that this, for example, has to do with the number of Goldstone modes, which the XY model has one Goldstone mode and the Heisenberg has two. So it could be that this is a manifestation of that. But that remains to be explored by looking at other models where these simple kind of rationalizations actually hold true or not. And then like as a last comment on this part, as I said initially, we know that if you take the 2D classical Ising model and you embed that in a finite bond dimension PEPS, you can do that and you will get infinite correlation length in the plane. And so how is that actually different to what we're looking at? And I have this kind of drawn such a picture that if we actually looking at the Lorentz invariant case and we somehow set our velocity to kind of to 1, then we have a situation where the Lorentz invariance somehow leads. So the fact kind of that we use a finite bond dimension, it somehow limits the kind of the temporal correlation length to a finite or to a short value. And now the idea is a bit, if you have a system which has a finite temporal correlation value and it's a Lorentz invariant system, this actually also has to translate into a finite correlation length in the spatial part. And the spatial correlation length, that's what we're measuring. And so somehow we think that putting a finite bond dimension kind of in D is somehow limiting the path integrals in the temporal direction. And therefore, since the system is Lorentz invariant, we inherit a finite correlation length in the spatial part. And that's actually in these cases like the 2D classical Ising partition function. You can really kind of isolate a single slice at constant time and still have algebraic correlations in the plane, but since somehow your temporal correlation length is kind of zero, that's something you can represent in a PEPS. But as soon as you work with Lorentz invariant system, I think the bond dimension D introduces a finite temporal correlation length, and then that will also lead to a finite correlation length in the spatial direction. Okay? And so I think this is now, since my 45 minutes are now up, so I think this is also the conclusion of the talk. So we think we have now rather accurate energies and critical exponents for the D equals 3 Ising model already with a rather small bond dimension of D equals 3. So that's bond dimension, that's space-time dimension. And so we saw that according to our calculation, the correlation lengths stay finite for all couplings, even though we're actually optimizing a quantum critical system. But this is not too bad because we now have a framework where this finite correlation length is actually also a blessing because we can use it to extrapolate energies and order parameters to the kind of the bond dimension to infinity limit, which I think is quite useful. And okay, that's some broader picture. So we actually think, for example, due to the fact that these PEPs, for example, have a spontaneous magnetic moment in many cases, you can perhaps also see that as a self-detuned version of the PEPs gapping itself out by adding a relevant perturbation to the gapless fixed point, rendering the state gap, and then it has a finite correlation length. And so we think also that this is history of the correlation length, whether your PEPs has finite correlation length or not. I think you have to see that in the context of the actual space-time volume. So if you have a state which really explores like the temporal direction in the path integrals in a significant way, then I think the PEPs will probably not be able to maintain critical correlations, but otherwise it can. And so these results, even though we were looking at kind of Drosophila models so far, but many of the things we looked at will actually be important as the underlying mechanisms, even if you look at superfluids or Hubbard model, for example, for superconductors, these are also kind of Goldstone modes, but also for gapless quantum spin liquids where we have fermionic and bosonic degrees of freedom. And it will also be important to understand how, for example, an IPEPS will gap itself out if it wants to describe a Dirac spin liquid, for example. And these are things which I think are not so well understood. Okay? And so if you're interested in that part, come and talk to me later if you want. And I thank you for your attention.